The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Pretty Designs, Tough Environment. Triangle architectural and construction firms are pivoting to attract new jobs as commercial real estate work slows. And the article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Back to the Drawing Board. Architecture and engineering firms rode the coattails of commercial developers during the pandemic boom, but are now facing a change in activity. And this is written by Laura Bromet. Big-name developers made headlines during the pandemic for bringing dozens of projects to the Triangle. Both local and out-of-state players raced to announce and build developments, creating a commercial real estate boom. Behind the scenes, architecture and engineering firms rushed to meet the demand for their services. More projects meant more site plans, more renderings, and more revenue. Now, halfway through 2023, activity has cooled in commercial real estate, but the dependent relationship between the architecture and engineering firms and commercial development remains. So after the roaring business of late 2020, 2021, and early 2022, Triangle firms are hunkering down. The types of projects happening have shifted, and the Triangle market is looking slightly less shiny to out-of-state firms. Meanwhile, local firms are relying on their relationships with clients and lessons learned from past recessions to navigate the change in business while hoping to keep employees. The growth of design contracts, project inquiries, and billings was down nationally in May compared to the same month in 2022, according to the American Institute of Architects. The Architecture Billings Index, or ABI, measures non-residential construction activity with a lead time of 9 to 12 months. The ABI showed growth was lower this May compared to 2022 across design contracts, project inquiries, and billings. The index first took a dip in October 2022 and hasn't reached early 2022 levels since. And in the Triangle, some announced projects touting glittering renderings and high price tags are on hold as developers grapple with high interest rates rise and challenging financing. The developers behind the Creamery, a major mixed-use project planned for downtown Raleigh's Glenwood South that was approved in 2022, hit pause on the project but now plan to start construction in the middle of 2024. Michael Mesnard, president and managing partner of Klein Design Associates, has seen similar concerns among the firm's developer clients. It's a matter of helping them rework their plan and how they can get it done, Mesnard says. They've told us it's going to take a little bit longer to get the deals done as they work with their investment partners, the banks, and all the components that are needed to put a deal together. But the Triangle could still be in a better position than some other markets. Billings data collected by the American Institute of Architects in May showed the South above the nation's other three regions over a three-month moving average. They're continuing to evaluate how to get a deal done, Mesnard says. I think every one of our developers and our clients are still very high on this market and other markets in North and South Carolina and even in other Southeast regions. Sizzling hot. While the onset of the pandemic caused turmoil for industries such as restaurants and lodging, other sectors found opportunity. Commercial real estate across the country benefited from the slash in interest rates, but some markets, including the Triangle, saw a stronger surge in activity. Being shut inside during quarantine prompted thousands of residents to leave large metropolitan areas such as New York City seeking a better quality of life. North Carolina's mild climate and the Triangle's relatively low cost of living caused many migrants to land in the region. Population growth meant more housing was needed, and the Triangle's low single-family home inventory made rentable units high in demand. Plans for multifamily projects, from townhomes to apartment complexes, piled into municipal offices. The supply chain meltdown sparked in the early months of the pandemic proved the need for more warehousing and industrial space to be built. And work-from-home policies meant more retail properties were needed closer to neighborhoods. Ted Van Dyke, owner and principal of New City Design, saw a jump in retail projects in the Triangle's bedroom communities. His Raleigh architecture firm opened in 1996 and has worked on projects such as downtown Raleigh's Morgan Street Food Hall. A lot of our local clients, they realized people were still going to have to go to the grocery store. Retail really weathered the storm pretty well, and we're heavy in that market, Van Dyke says. So after an initial jolt of, the world is coming to an end and we're going to have to furlough everybody, things for us percolated back fairly quickly. Along with more projects, Van Dyke also saw the demand for registered architects rise as well. The high volume of development in the Triangle attracted architecture firms from out of state, and companies began trying to build a presence in the region. Some newcomers in the field tried to partner with local firms, while others established satellite offices in the area. HDR out of Omaha, Nebraska was one such architecture and engineering firm that put a team in Raleigh. The $2.8 billion firm is one of the largest in the country and previously only had engineers in the Triangle. HDR hired two longtime Triangle architects away from other firms to lead the office. Firms such as EDSA of Florida and Phase Zero Design of Massachusetts both credited the Triangle area's rapid growth as their reason for opening offices in the region. Van Dyke's firm, with 7 registered architects and 15 employees total, was a target for recruiters and headhunters looking to lure local talent, he says. The cool down. For Raleigh's Klein Design, the boom in commercial development during the pandemic caused both employee count and revenue to rise. Klein Design had 55 employees in the Triangle, including 20 registered architects, and $16.3 million in revenue at the end of 2018. At the end of 2022, the firm had 82 total employees in the area with $33.44 million in revenue. The firm's number of registered architects in the Triangle, 24, made it the second largest in the region. But halfway through 2023, some areas of commercial real estate are seeing trouble. A slowdown is happening in the sector, with high interest rates making developers cautious and financing hard to come by. The apparent permanence of hybrid and work-from-home models is making demand for new office projects, especially large towers and city centers, nearly extinct. At Klein Design, the cooling isn't causing despair. Things have slowed down a little bit, but quite frankly, we were moving at a pace in the last couple of years that wasn't sustainable, Mesnard says. In some ways, it's a little bit of a welcome slowdown as we continue to develop our processes and strategic initiatives that we have. Klein Design does primarily developer-based work, he says. Its past work includes the Peace Raleigh Apartments and Publix in downtown Raleigh's Smoky Hollow, the new Seaboard Station development by Hoffman and Associates, and Willard Street Apartments in Durham. Recently, the firm invited one of its top developer clients to the Klein Design office in downtown Raleigh. Once the slowdown in commercial development became apparent, Klein wanted to learn about the situation from the developers themselves. We understand their business, and that's the value add that we bring. And so we wanted to understand what was going on a little bit more right now with interest rates and supply chain issues and all of the things that the market seems to be facing, Mesnard says. Over 20 Klein employees met to hear about interest rates, yield rates, capital markets, and the developers' investment partners. After the discussion, Mesnard felt optimistic. If one area of business is slowing, developers are pivoting to other projects, he says. It's just another downturn, right? It's a cycle that we go through. We've seen it before, and it's just a matter of kind of waiting it out, Mesnard says. That's what's driving me to remain optimistic on what's happening as we go through this process. Lessons learned. Seppi Saidi cycled through downturns during her 22 years as the head of her namesake engineering firm, Seppi Incorporated. She sold the Raleigh firm last year, transitioning the 330 employees to the Trans Systems name. Saidi remains involved as a top Trans Systems shareholder and executive vice president of its board of directors. The talks of a potential recession earlier this year brought flashbacks for many. In the Great Recession in 2008 and 2009, Saidi says the commercial private sector and the public sector both came to a screeching halt. I just had to cut costs, cut costs, cut costs, she says. I mean, deeply. We had to cut everything, not just sponsorships, but some employees. Anything that was overhead, we had to cut. And we had no clarity of how long it was going to take for it to bounce back. Projects got abruptly canceled. Some developers didn't pay. At the time, Saidi pivoted to the federal market. The switch from private work to public work is difficult, but federal projects were some of the only opportunities in the state during the crisis. North Carolina is home to one of the only two military bases that grew during the recession, Fort Bragg, now Fort Liberty. And after about a year and a half of pivoting, Seppi won a contract. Saidi carries that Great Recession lesson with her now. Diversifying the types of projects the firm can do allows for a cushion if one sector slows down. Now, for example, some private projects, such as office towers, are hitting roadblocks, but public projects are hotter than ever, she says. And many municipalities have federal money from COVID-19 relief efforts to spend. For example, Wake County recently passed three bonds to fund parks and recreation, schools, and community colleges. But for firms traditionally focused on private projects, jumping to public projects isn't easy, Saidi says. Public projects can be as lucrative as private projects, but they operate at a much slower pace. The internal shift could take at least a year, but hurdles stand in actually landing the projects as well. Winning projects often comes down to relationships between architecture and engineering firms, and some firms have spent years making a name for themselves in the public space. Beyond diversifying with both public and private clients, Saidi also believes expanding into multiple cities and states is a route firms will have to take to stay successful moving forward. That's a really smart business plan, generally diversifying into various sectors and types of projects in multiple states, she says. Different states have different economic profiles. If you're growing over a certain number of employees, then I think it's really important to be in different markets. Looking ahead, the second half of 2023 will likely see struggles for architecture firms nationally, says Kermit Baker, chief economist at the American Institute of Architects, told the Business Journals. Most AIA-affiliated firms are expecting flat growth for the year, following a revenue jump of 7% last year. Layoffs aren't prevalent in the industry yet, but that could change based on a firm's geographic location and sector focus, he says. But both architecture and engineering firms in the Triangle region are facing the latter half of the year with confidence. Raleigh's Kimley Horn, the second largest engineering firm in the market, has no plans for layoffs and is planning to continue hiring, says Neil Deans, the senior vice president leading the Southeast region. I have no concerns regarding overhiring or potential layoffs. At Kimley Horn, we closely monitor our workload in the various markets we serve, he says. Kimley Horn has a very diverse set of clients across an equally diverse set of markets. This diversity pays dividends. The firm has made three senior-level hires in the past 3 weeks, senior recruiter Jason Ybarra says. And Kimley Horn continued its summer internship program, hiring around 1,000 college students. Part of Kimley Horn's durability stems from its internal operations. The firm operates as one profit center, making it possible for work to be shared between departments and markets, Ybarra says. The firm's diverse client base provides opportunities to spread work among all of its employees. If the business is slowing in one sector or market, employees in those areas can shift to other projects in the firm. Not a lot of firms can say that, and I think that's what's allowed us to be effective in today's times, Ybarra says. Though optimistic, Deans' confidence in Kimley Horn's business isn't blind. We've anticipated and planned for clients in nearly all of our industries who will be more cautious about investing, and there will be some that remain bullish, he says. That's a shift from the past few years when sentiment was overwhelmingly positive across the board. It is important to acknowledge these market shifts, as there are economic indicators that differ this year, and our society is still adapting to evolving work patterns and their wider impact, Dean says. However, when looking at the broader picture, the Triangle region and North Carolina as a whole is showing growth, with much to offer for businesses and families. While the Triangle seems stronger than some others, the region might not keep all firms afloat with a dip in demand. Longtime Triangle firms that have strong footholds in the market can pull on their established relationships and reputations to carry them through the year. But out-of-state firms and newcomers don't have the advantages of repeat customers or word-of-mouth recommendations. For them, it's going to be a much tougher situation. It's trust. It takes a long time to build communication with the client. It makes it more difficult for the newcomers, Saidi says. Transsystems has the benefit of CEPI's years of doing business in the market, and the firm now has a strong backlog of work and is still looking to hire, Saidi says. But we'll be cautious, she says. We're watching the markets to be able to react. I think everybody should seriously do that and make sure they're being proactive. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Soccer match no money grab for UNC. An epic night in Keenan Stadium featuring two British soccer teams won't be the windfall for the University of North Carolina, despite the huge crowd. We were hoping for a sellout, and we got it, says Clint Gwaltney, the senior associate athletics director at UNC. More than 50,000 people watched Chelsea of the English Premier League play Wrexham from Wales. Keenan could host soccer after removing the hedges that once lined the field in 2017. UNC is now using turf, not grass, so grass had to be imported. Figuring out how to water it was one of the many operational challenges, Gwaltney says. Whether more events will follow is hard to say. Keenan Stadium hasn't had a concert since Bruce Springsteen in 2003, Gwaltney says. We're still riding the high of the success of the event, he says of the soccer match. We haven't debriefed about what the future looks like, but we are open to another event like this. Most musical groups can't fill a stadium, and the ones that can are more likely to go to larger markets, Gwaltney says, and the vast majority of funds don't go to the venue. We'll evaluate anybody, he says, but the deals have to be favorable financially. As for Chelsea Wrexham, Gwaltney expects Carolina's share of the proceeds to be well below $500,000, a small number for a school with an athletics budget that exceeds $120 million. This was not a money grab, Gwaltney says. Raleigh's massive creamery project now set to begin next year. A massive project that will transform Raleigh's Glenwood South is back on track. Turnbridge Equities anticipates starting construction on the huge creamery development in mid-2024, beginning with the 36-story residential tower. The two-story project also includes a 20-story office tower and preservation of the creamery building at 400 and 410 Glenwood Avenue. A public utility hold that stops any site permits from being issued caused the company to delay its original start date of 2022. Managing Director Jason Davis says Turnbridge Equities now has the necessary permits. We've reevaluated how to build the project in light of changes to the market that we've seen over the last year. There's been a decent amount of redesign to be able to break the project apart and phase it the way we are, Davis says. GalaxyCon brings crowd to convention center. GalaxyCon is back in Raleigh for the fifth time, and this year's attendance is expected to be the highest yet. The four-day event is expecting 50,000 people, up from the 42,500 that attended last year. GalaxyCon began July 27 and runs through July 30 at the Raleigh Convention Center. It's a welcome sight for downtown Raleigh as the area looks to regain the vibe it had before the pandemic. Upcoming events at the Raleigh Convention Center include the NC International Auto Club and IBMA's World of Bluegrass in September. The convention is designed for fans of comic books, pop culture, gaming, movies, and more. It's one of the biggest events at the convention center and has been growing since it began in 2017. This year, celebrity guests include William Shatner of Star Trek fame and Giancarlo Esposito, known for playing Gus Fring in Breaking Bad. Fans of Chapel Hill's Med Deli show support. The stunning fire that gutted the Mediterranean Deli, Bakery, and Catering in Chapel Hill sparked a remarkable surge of support for the Franklin Street Institution. A GoFundMe started to help employees of the Med Deli surge to past $176,000 in just a matter of days as donations flooded in. Jerry Lynn Schulke, the interim director of the Chapel Hill Downtown Partnership, said the response speaks volumes about how people feel about the restaurant, and Jamil Kadura, who grew up in Jerusalem and opened it in 1991. It's like he's fed our community, she said. Once you've been fed by somebody, it's like your family. That's what people feel like, that Med Deli is part of our family. Stunning coastal home up for sale. A coastal home with 14 rooms situated on 59 acres is for sale for $8.25 million. The Flowers Landing Estate, located at 220 Pungo Shores Drive in Belhaven, listed July 24, according to Chris Respis, a real estate broker selling the property. The house now hosts events such as retreats and weddings, according to Respis, and was built in 2000. He says the house was last purchased around 2010. The main home is more than 7,000 square feet, and the property includes four guest homes. Additionally, there are 15 acres of wildlife and over 3,000 feet of river frontage along the Pungo River. And finally, Florida firm buys land for solar plant. A new kind of farm is planned for Nash County. Skylight Solar, an LLC tied to Next Era Energy Resources of Florida, purchased more than 850 acres of land last month for about $4.2 million, according to Nash County Records. NextEra Energy runs wind, solar, nuclear, and other energy operations throughout the United States. According to county documents, Skylight Solar submitted a rezoning request to develop an approximately 78.3 megawatt solar facility. And now we turn to the top news stories in the Triangle Business Journal. First one's written by Kaylee Thompson. Fuquay Verena looking to transform its downtown. Fuquay Verena is looking to shake up the look of its downtown as it seeks a developer for town-owned land. The town has put out a request for qualifications for a 2.52-acre site in the heart of its downtown. Assistant Town Manager Jim Seymour says the town is looking to build a downtown transformational mixed-use development. The site is 7 lots next to Town Hall on Main Street. While the town is open to all ideas, Seymour says the town specifically is looking to have a vertical development with retail, restaurant, and office space on the first floor and potentially residences above. With the retail and restaurant space, the town is looking to have a mix of local and national businesses. Our primary focus is trying to get additional commercial, retail, and restaurant downtown, new opportunities in supporting our already established downtown business district, and then usually part of these projects, residential is part of that project to support it, Seymour says. The development is part of the town's effort to revitalize and invest in its downtown, including upgrading infrastructure and building facade improvements. It also fulfills the town's goal to prioritize infill development. It's a trend playing out across the Triangle as multiple small towns are looking to update or transform their downtowns to boost tourism and support the already present businesses. The town of Cary put out an RFQ in May to completely reimagine its downtown. The town of Morrisville has been working on creating a downtown as it really doesn't have one. And Chapel Hill's Franklin Street has been undergoing transformation for a couple of years. In Fuquay Verena, the 7 lots are zoned, Downtown Center 1 and won't need to be rezoned. The current zoning supports up to 5 stories, and the town is interested in a 3 to 5 story building being built. The development will also need to include some sort of parking component to assist in parking solutions for downtown Fuquay Verena. Seymour says the mayor and town board have committed to financially contribute to the development. And our next story, also written by Kaylee Thompson, deal for Knightdale project closes. 2 separate transactions totaling $12.5 million closed for nearly 90 acres. A big mixed-use development in Knightdale is moving forward after closing the land deal for $12.5 million in a split between 2 buyers. Stanley Martin Homes paid a little more than $8 million for 54.5 acres to develop the residential side, while a joint partnership between JPM South Development and Alliance Group of NC paid about $4.3 million for 35.24 acres to develop the commercial portion. The deal was done in 2 transactions and closed on July 14, according to Wake County deed records. The development, which has plans for more than 500 housing units, is on 7 parcels on Smithfield Road, 1st and 4th Avenues. It is across the street from Knightdale Station Park and near Knightdale Crossing Shopping Center, and indicates the continued interest in the town, which has boomed in recent years. Knightdale had a population of 19,703 in 2022, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. JPM South Development is the master developer behind the project. Alliance Group of NC was unavailable to comment. JPM and Alliance Group will either develop the commercial and multifamily properties or sell it off to other developers, according to broker William White of White Oak Commercial, who brokered the transaction. Stanley Martin Homes was brought on board by Alliance Group to develop the residences, as Alliance had worked with Stanley Martin in the past and felt the home builder would be a good fit for the development, according to Raleigh Division President Hampton Pitts. The residences will include single-family homes, townhomes, and condominiums. The condos will be 2 bedrooms and the same floor plan as the condos in the home builder's Axis at Grove 98 development in Wake Forest. Those condos start at $375,000. The townhomes will be 3 bedrooms, and single-family homes will have floor plans up to 5 bedrooms. The floor plans will be a mix of the home builder's existing and new plans, but with a brand-new project-specific front elevation. Pitt said the company anticipates breaking ground in fourth quarter 2023 and beginning construction on the first set of homes in summer 2024. UNC Health laying off nearly 250 employees. This article written by Zach Ezone. UNC Health plans to lay off almost 250 employees as it winds down operations at a behavioral health facility in Raleigh. The health system on July 21 informed the NC Department of Commerce of its plans to discontinue services at Wakebrook Behavioral Health Facility by September 30. This will lead to the health system separating with 246 employees. The Wakebrook facility is owned by Wake County but has been operated by UNC Health for about a decade. The two entities were not able to reach an agreement to extend this partnership, leading this long-term contract to expire this year. As a result, Wake County on July 10 announced that UNC Health will end all services at the facility by October. It's unfortunate that after discussing several different proposals with UNC Health, we could not settle on terms for a service contract, Wake County Manager David Ellis said in a statement. Wakebrook is an important care center in our community. Wakebrook plans a big role in the behavioral plays a big role in the behavioral health services that Wake County supports. The county during fiscal year 2022 had a behavioral health budget of about $35.3 million, of which about $14 million supported services at Wakebrook, according to a recent county report. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the reporter pages, starting with Lauren Onosorge's page on tech and finance. Amel Carr to lead Wolfspeed's digital push. Chip company wants to automate new plant in Chatham County. The pressure is on for Priya Amel Carr, the innovator charged with leading Wolfspeed's digital strategy as chief information officer, and that includes automation for its new $5 billion factory under construction in Chatham County. Wolfspeed has done it before, having automated its Mohawk Valley plant in New York, but the $5 billion facility in Chatham County is an entirely new beast. Wolfspeed calls it the largest plant of its kind. Now we're going to have to do brand new automation for the materials facility in Siler City, Amel Carr says. I think there are a lot of possibilities for us to do things that have never been done before, not only for the business side, but also for the IT side. We're going to be automating something that has not been automated before. Amel Carr says her entire career has been leading to this moment. She was always a math kid, she says. I like the fact that within IT you see a problem and you solve it, she says. You see an impact right away. I think the instant gratification was definitely something that excited me. Amel Carr was born in India but spent much of her young life in Indonesia. She ended up in ended up at Oklahoma State University, a culture shock, she says. She considered moving home after graduation, but her parents told her to work for a year and see what you like. That turned into a 25-year IT career, starting at Sprint as a server engineer. I realized pretty quickly that sitting in dark, cold data centers wasn't my thing, she says. So I moved into project management because I love working with people and partnering with business stakeholders to deliver solutions. Amel Carr's career took her in several different directions. Prior to Wolfspeed, she spent 6 years at Global Foundries. It was the impact that attracted her to Wolfspeed. We, as a company, are looking for silicon carbide, looking to change how the power industry is going to be looking in a few years, and that's what got me excited, she says. The richest revenue routes at RDU. Airlines have pocketed hundreds of millions in revenue from flights serving Raleigh-Durham International Airport in recent months. That's according to research firm OAG, which estimates that RDU's top round-trip route in terms of revenue is Denver. For the 12-month period from June 2022 through May 2023, the RDU-Denver route inked nearly $139.6 million in revenue, according to OAG, eclipsing other routes such as San Francisco, $113.7 million, and Orlando, Florida, $110 million. Denver is served by three carriers out of RDU: Frontier Airlines, Southwest Airlines, and United Airlines, but it's not the most popular metro for RDU flyers post-pandemic. If you add both New York's LaGuardia and JFK airports, New York rises to the top at nearly $220.5 million in revenue over the time period, according to OAG data. Semiconductor firm to expand in RTP. Semiconductor company Analog Devices has big plans for the Triangle, starting with a new regional operation in Research Triangle Park with space for another 100 employees. Some of those sites were aging and we were thinking about what our strategy should be, says Greg Henderson, senior vice president of the company's automotive and energy, communications and aerospace group. Analog Devices, which is headquartered in Massachusetts, has been in North Carolina since 1978. And finally, Jurassic Capital closes first fund. Jurassic Capital, a Durham growth equity firm founded by former Bronto Software CEO Joe Colopy, has closed its inaugural fund, Jurassic Capital Growth Fund 1, with more than $30 million in commitments. Colopy details when a Fund 2 might come into play. We fully plan on that, he says. We have to finish deploying the capital for this fund, and then somewhere in there we will start crafting what is Jurassic Capital Growth Fund 2. And now we turn to On Healthcare and Higher Ed, written by Zach Ezone. Pfizer plant in Nash likely closed for weeks. Manufacturing plant could alleviate supply chain issues. Pfizer's manufacturing facility in Rocky Mount will likely remain closed for weeks after sustaining damage from a tornado that ripped across eastern North Carolina on July 19. The closure has spurred concerns over potential drug shortages at hospitals in North Carolina and nationwide, with the facility being responsible for manufacturing about 8% of all sterile injectables used in U.S. hospitals. Production facilities were not damaged, but the warehouse was nearly destroyed, said Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla during a July 21 press conference. The warehouse stores raw ingredients used to make medicines, as well as packaging supplies and some finished medicines waiting shipment. Engineers are assessing the structural integrity of the site, but even in the absence of structural damage, it'll take weeks before production restarts at the facility, Bourla says. Power needs to be restored and the right temperature needs to be maintained given the focus of the site, sterile injectables such as anesthesia and therapeutics. The company is in the process of moving product to other sites for storage and working to replace damaged raw materials and other supplies. Pfizer is also looking at alternative manufacturing locations while the site is shut down, including its large manufacturing facility in Sanford. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is working with Pfizer to assess how the site's closure will affect drug supplies for hospitals. In a statement, FDA Commissioner Robert Califf said the FDA isn't expecting any immediate significant impacts, given there are products already at hospitals and the distribution system. Pfizer's 3,200-worker Rocky Mount facility is the sole source for the U.S. market of fewer than 10 drugs, Califf said, while not disclosing the specific products. However, there are substitutes or weeks' worth of stock available in other Pfizer warehouses for a number of the drugs. For its part, Bourla said Pfizer's top priority is minimizing supply disruptions. The company will prioritize the areas of higher risk, such as products that, if out of supply, can lead to serious health issues. From there, the company will gradually expand as the plant returns to full manufacturing capacity. We have a monumental task in front of us to make sure that we're bringing back to normality everything so that people will not feel the pain because of the lack of important medicines, Bourla said. The weeks-long shutdown is a situation that hospitals are closely watching. UNC Health, for instance, is expecting some level of disruption to its entire system. RTP Biotech leaves NASDAQ after acquisition. A consortium led by the private equity firm Fall Line Capital has acquired Greenlight Biosciences. This comes a little more than a year after the biotech, which is headquartered near Boston and has key operations in Research Triangle Park, went public through a merger with a special purpose acquisition company. Greenlight first announced the roughly $46 million cash deal in late May after months of dealing with financial challenges. The biotech's cash total at the end of March was about $32.4 million. Through its merger with the group led by Fall Line Capital, Greenlight closed on about $52.1 million of financing. The company says the merger and this financing will provide for increased efficiency and nimbleness to adapt to changing market opportunities. Greenlight CEO Andrew Zarur will continue to lead the company. And finally, 9meters ceases ops, files for bankruptcy. A small drug developer in Raleigh has ceased operations and filed for bankruptcy after failing to secure additional funding. Like other small drug developers, 9meters Biopharma struggled to raise capital in a challenging financial market. a challenging financial environment. The three-year-old company ended March with $6.9 million in unrestricted cash and cash equivalents, down from $12.6 million at the end of last year. Despite efforts to extend its cash runway or bring in more capital, the company's board of directors determined to file for bankruptcy upon review and consideration of the company's inability to continue operations at a level sufficient to satisfy outstanding and expected future obligations, according to a statement. And our last reporter page in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal is written by Laura Bromette on retail and restaurants. New Raleigh Hotel to be part of Hilton Curio. The seven-story, 153-room hotel will feature a rooftop bar. The former K&W cafeteria building in the Village District is set to be demolished to make way for a new hotel. Named the Oberlin Hotel, the building will rise seven stories and have 153 guest rooms. A longtime Triad Group, Quality Oil Company, is the hotel's developer and management company. The new hotel will be part of Hilton's Curio Collection portfolio. The brand is known for upscale boutique-style properties. The selected hotels are supported by Hilton but retain individual branding. North Carolina has only one property in the Curio collection, the Foundry Hotel Asheville. The Oberlin Hotel will be at the intersection of Woodburn Road and Smallwood Drive. The building will measure around 115,000 square feet. The project will also include a parking deck for use by hotel customers and visitors to the Village District. The hotel's sixth floor roof area will feature a signature high-end restaurant and rooftop bar promising views of downtown Raleigh. Its lobby will also feature a cocktail bar along with a market-style cafe. The property will include meeting and banquet space, a courtyard and covered patio, a stage for live music, and on-site catering. Construction is set to begin with the demolition of the former K&W cafeteria building in late July. The hotel is slated to open in the summer of 2025. The project has been in the works since fall 2021. Issam Ham Design Group is the architect for the project, and Matthews Construction is the contractor. The hotel's name was chosen as an ode to the neighborhood's history as a freedman's village, says Graham Bennett, president of Quality Oil Company. These folks made a lasting impact on Raleigh and the entire country because of what they achieved, and we think this special hotel will honor them and the Oberlin name, he says. Quality Oil was founded in Winston-Salem in 1929 and now owns dozens of gas stations across the state. The company branched out into hotel development in the 1970s. The Oberlin Hotel will be the company's first boutique project. Carey Cigar Shop to host bar and private club. The Cigar Box, located in the West Park Place Shopping Center off Highway 55 near High House Road, is taking over the neighboring unit with plans to expand the business. The shop is owned by Steve Norell, who also owns Cigar Box locations in Southern Pines and Hope Mills. Norell purchased the Carey business last April and rebranded it from K&S Cigars to the Cigar Box name. The demand for cigar shops in the Triangle far outweighs the supply, he says. The current unit measures 1,500 square feet, and the expansion will add another 1,600 square feet. The addition will hold a full bar serving beer, wine, and spirits, along with a fireplace and a seating area. The new room will be a private club, Norell says. Customers can gain access by spending $25 at the shop, purchasing a $25 day pass, or by buying a yearly membership. The fee is not yet set in stone, but could be around $500. And the final story, plans approved, but no demo date set for Round Holiday Inn. Developers have approval to replace Raleigh's Round Holiday Inn, but the timeline is unclear. The unique structure has stood on Hillsborough Street since the 1960s and will be torn down to make room for apartment units and a Kimpton Hotel. Triangle Business Journal first reported the news in early 2022 after obtaining plans for a mixed-use tower on the property. Now those plans have been approved by the city, but the developer does not have a demolition date set, a Title Real Estate Partner spokesperson says. The Holiday Inn's website shows the ability to book rooms through November, but not for December. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Maybe building smaller houses is the answer. Surprising very few, the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller Index on July 25 showed home prices across the nation rose 0.7% from April to May. For the Triangle, it was much higher for people keeping score. But what was surprising was that home prices in the Rust Belt started going up after years of decline. Prices in Chicago gained 4.6%, in Cleveland 3.9%, and in New York 3.5%, making for the top performers. The Midwest took over the South's reign as the strongest region. According to the index, prices had topped out in June 2022 before falling, but in the last 4 months of this year, prices have started escalating. As many may remember, my column last week that showed how fast resale home prices are growing in the Triangle and how things are likely to get worse for prospective buyers. Over the past few days, home builders such as Lennar, D.R. Horton, Pulte Homes, Toll Brothers, and many others have started releasing or are about to release their earnings reports, and all of them are expected to show strong results. And yet, the National Association of Home Builders announced recently that building permits are down nationally, although the Triangle continues to show stronger numbers. So what is the immediate solution for folks in the Raleigh-Durham area and other parts of the country where people continue to move in every single day? So I did some math, thanks to the folks who put out the housing metrics report for us. For example, in Wake County right now, the average size of a home on the market is about 2,600 square feet, which amounts to about $220 per square foot. In 2018, the average square footage of a sold house in Wake County was about 2,652, but the price per square foot was about $146. In 2013, the size was about 2,660, and the price per square foot was $115. Essentially, the price has doubled in 10 years. Private developers argue the cost of building homes has skyrocketed, and they always point out the acceleration of land prices as one of the primary factors. Several studies have shown land price accounts for about 25% of the total cost of a sold home. If the home sells for $400,000, the land price is typically $100,000. Perhaps that's where the opportunity is for municipalities looking to address affordability in their neighborhoods. What if municipalities bought the land and demanded developers cut 25% of the listing price? But that's just one issue, and it really does not address affordability. 25% of $550,000 is still a big number. That's where municipalities work with developers to build houses half the current size. So the average home size goes down to 1,300 square feet, and the price per square foot goes down to $165 a square foot after the 25% land cut cost. Now we're talking about a $215,000 brand new house, thanks to a private-public partnership. Going vertical with such a plan likely has better use of land and adds density. I know I'm using simple math, and for municipalities, developers, and investors to get through the rezoning process, it is far more complicated than that. But perhaps we need to work backward toward getting an affordable option. Just winking at developers to submit a housing plan that has workforce housing tied to average median income is not enough. And these numbers from Case-Shiller show escalating housing prices are spreading everywhere, and sans a deep economic calamity or a massive increase in wages, new financial models need to be adopted to accommodate the next generation of homebuyers, and it starts with size. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to some news from around the state. City seeks proposals for three properties. Charlotte wants developers to detail project's plan. This is written by Eric Spanberg. Charlotte City government has spent $10.8 million acquiring, demolishing, and managing three properties in struggling areas in hopes of reducing crime and blight while increasing private investment. Over the next 6 weeks, they're going to find out whether the strategy can succeed. The city will start accepting proposals in August from private developers to remake the shuttered properties and in the process provide a direct response to the effort to spur investment. Each property is in one of the city's designated corridors of opportunity. The properties up for redevelopment? A 4.33-acre site next to the Hidden Valley neighborhood and within the Sugar Creek Road Interstate 85 corridor that was home to an economy inn formerly mired in crime. The property includes three motel buildings and a management building, all dating to 1972. City Council this year approved $4.2 million to buy the property, and the city has since spent another $1 million on the site. Demolition has yet to be finished. The city is seeking proposals for affordable housing, for sale housing, not rental houses or units, for families with incomes 80% or less of area median income. In Charlotte, that's roughly $80,000 and below annually for a family of four. It will be rezoned for housing. According to neighborhood data, median income around the site is $39,000, and 41% of immediate residents qualify for food and nutrition programs. Proposals are due August 15. An 11.2-acre site on Woodward Avenue that was the former home of Double Oaks School closed in 1981. The city bought the property for $3.1 million and has spent another $740,000 on maintenance, demolition, and management of the site. It's part of the city's North Tryon, North Graham corridor. The shuttered school is near three neighborhoods, Brightwalk, Genesis Park, and Oaklawn. According to the neighborhood profile data, 2,000 people live in the immediate area around the property. And we have a story from the Triad Business Journal. Milken ranks Burlington high on its list. Just as its largest private employer is deepening its local investment, Burlington is getting recognition for several years of attention to economic development, with its ranking jumping to the top 20 in its size group. The Milken Institute ranked Burlington 14th among 203 smaller metropolitan statistical areas in its 2023 assessment of the best performing cities in the United States. It's a jump of 22 spots from 2022 and is the highest ranking for small metros in North Carolina. Milken attributed the jump mainly to strong and diverse wage growth, noting wages increased 13% in a year and nearly 36% over 5 years, placing Burlington 11th and 18th in its size group by those metrics. It noted wages grew more than 50% in Burlington's retail trade, transportation, financial activity sector, and professional and business services. In its annual rankings, Milken mentioned Burlington's largest employer, LabCorp, noting its plan for a $71 million investment into a base for its aviation division at the Burlington-Alamance Regional Airport. And now we turn to the big number sections that are spread throughout the Triangle Business Journal. Our first big number, $600,000. That's about how much UNC Chapel Hill estimates it will spend annually as part of its efforts to ensure that students from families in North Carolina that make less than $80,000 a year have a path to attend the university free of tuition and fees. The university plans to use its own funds from private donations to cover costs. And only one other big number, 10. That's how many more tenants have signed on to open in a new development in Apex. The mixed-use project, Sweetwater Town Center, is now 88% pre-leased. New tenants include Mama Bird's Ice Cream, BYH Clothing, BFT Fitness, Mi Cancun Mexican Cantina, Master Kim Martial Arts, and Sobol. And now we'll read through the quotes in the he said it or she said it sections. The first one is from Arvind Krishna, IBM CEO, on how Big Blue is all in on artificial intelligence. He told analysts this month the strategy to bolster AI will be similar to IBM's expansion of its hybrid cloud business, the Red Hat buy. We will play out AI in a similar way. And our next quote is from Paula Brown Stafford, Novan CEO, on the company's decision to file for bankruptcy despite being only 6 months away from a possible regulatory approval. Novan on July 17 filed for bankruptcy and announced it was selling its assets. Adversity doesn't define you, and so this won't define me. And our last quote is from Keith Isselhart, Senior Vice President of Leasing at Brookfield Properties, on the addition of Charleston-based Co. or CO. restaurant brand to the Durham Mall. We have not had a full-service Asian restaurant at the streets of South Point in some time, so we believe CO. will be a great addition to our strong lineup of dining options. And next in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read a 52 Shades of Success, Earth and Equity article written by Connie Gentry. ESG lands in court. The threat of ESG litigation could suppress greenwashing and move companies from making public commitments into a mode of green hushing. Litigation stemming from environmental, social, and governance issues is on the rise. Earlier this month, Bloomberg Law reported that 146 ESG-related lawsuits were filed in federal district courts from the start of 2022 through the first quarter of this year. The lawsuits were categorized in four areas of emergent ESG risk: environmental justice, product advertising, corporate representations, and employment and DEI, with a fifth category, investment practices, noted as an area to watch. We are seeing an uptick for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of press and chatter going on about ESG. We have the SEC regulations potentially coming out that are going to be forcing more of that, and regulations in the EU are pushing for more disclosures, says Lisa Rushton, partner Womble Bond Dickinson. We also have litigation funders out there that are providing more financing for litigation. Momentum for ESG litigation is coming from both sides of the ESG debate. The trend that Todd Rossler, a partner at Kilpatrick Townsend, points to is an expansion from the traditional government-led actions to claims driven by more widespread public sentiment. The old regulator, that's the government, is certainly becoming more active, whether it's the SEC or the FTC. A number of agencies are very interested in ESG and are certainly ramping up their enforcement. But what we're seeing is a new regulator, and that new regulator is the public, whether it's a shareholders or investors, NGOs or customers. This new regulator is starting to hold companies accountable, Ressler says. And public sentiment is pushing accountability wider and deeper. Operations or actions that detrimentally impact the environment or community have been the basis of lawsuits for decades. Now there are a growing number of claims against companies and organizations for what they haven't done, essentially a failure to act on ESG commitments or establish protocols for preventative measures. Now we're seeing companies being sued on the disclosures they make in corporate sustainability reports, ESG reports, on their websites and in social media, Rossler says. Oftentimes, these are voluntary disclosures, not mandatory, and often they are made by marketing departments that don't go through the same checks and balances that financial disclosures go through when they're being reported to the SEC. Ambitious disclosures like a commitment to be net zero by 2040 or even by 2050 can backfire into a lawsuit if the company doesn't demonstrate that it has begun to take action on its commitments and is making measurable progress. Sometimes when you dig back behind those disclosures, there's not a lot of meat on the bones. Even if the company has a plan and if they're not implementing it, they need to be very careful with these voluntary disclosures, he says. The takeaway for businesses, advises Abigail Gamfer, legal analyst at Bloomberg Law, comes down to risk mitigation. Businesses should determine which ESG issues are material for them, and as the businesses are performing mitigation processes to address those risks, it's important to do so with the mind that there are serious ramifications if the risks are not addressed properly. This could end up in the courtroom, so from the start, businesses need to create proper ESG procedures and policies. In a similar vein, misleading claims of sustainable accomplishments or environmentally sound products are high risks for ESG litigation. We've really seen an increase recently in greenwashing or climate washing claims, Rushton says. The FTC has announced it is revising its green guides, and about 2 years ago, the SEC put together its task force to focus on that, so claims about misinformation are going to continue. And on the flip side, we've seen an uptick in what I'd call ESG backlash, where there's a bunch of red states that are pursuing claims or pushing legislation to stop investors from focusing on ESG as the purpose for their investment. The argument being that fiduciaries should be focusing on profit and not pushing a political agenda. Rushton also anticipates there could be impacts on ESG claims from the recent Supreme Court ruling that struck down affirmative action in college admissions. There's been talk about how that may impact DEI policies at the corporate level, she says. For example, the SEC ruling for at least one female board member and one underrepresented member on a board with mandated public disclosure on that is being challenged now. We may see more of those challenges moving forward in light of some of the dicta that was in the college admissions Supreme Court case. Another potential hotbed of controversy surrounds the practice of companies attempting to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions via carbon offset credits. Rossler points to a recent class action suit against Delta Airlines. The lawsuit basically says you're not really going to achieve net zero because you're relying on carbon offset credits, he says, noting there are a number of issues with carbon offset credits, including the idea of additionality. The fact that a project or improvement would have happened even without the carbon offset credits. Another potential liability is if the credits have been sold more than once, and also the timeliness of investment versus result. Carbon offset credits is a kind of a Wild West phenomenon, Rossler says. It's unregulated, and while there are verified carbon offset credits and ways to register your carbon offset credits, what happens if the company selling the credits is planting a forest to offset emissions that are happening right now? But those trees will take years, if not decades, to grow and take CO2 out of the air. As the ESG conversation becomes increasingly contentious and risks of litigation mount, some companies are taking a more silent stance, producing what's described as green hushing. Rossler is concerned that if companies are saying less, they're probably going to be doing less. Although his clients, who've talked about concerns over rising ESG litigation, have not stepped back to doing less. It's going to be interesting to see what happens as we move forward with those companies that are staying silent, Rushton says. Not all of the companies I work with have formal ESG programs, especially the private companies, but that's not to say they don't have a lot of the elements of an ESG program within what they do. I'd say there are very few companies out there that have turned a blind eye to ESG that aren't focused on things that impact the environment and DEI issues. Most companies are doing very positive things. They just may not be making public statements about it. And we'll close this week by turning in the Triangle Business Journal to the Business Pulse survey. The question, are you dining out more or less often than a year ago? Total number of responses, 136. 45% say about the same. 28% say less often, while 24% say more often, and 3% say I avoid dining out. And that'll wrap it up for us as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.